On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobel Prize-winning Irish poet Seamus Heaney, son of the farm and County Derry, put his spade in 40 years ago with a first poem called Digging. It was dense and sure, with a sense of place and earth that turned heads around the world. In the decades since, Heaney's rich, athletic poetry has ranged over myth and legend, politics and violence and the classics. Now he's back to earth and farm and sweat and tools. Not the marshmallow rubber dagger stuff, he says, but the feel of a sledgehammer, red meat and white string, the harrow pin and collie's stare, as it was in the beginning, he writes, but telling all there is to know. Up next on Point, the great Seamus Heaney and his new collection, District and Circle. Seamus Heaney, you've got a wonderful prose passage in your new collection, Mr. Heaney, called The Lagan's Road. I wish you'd set that up and maybe read it for us.
Yeah, The Lagan's Road was the road I went to school. I went along it to school, and actually it's risky, these things, for the readership, I think. The place meant a lot to me in memory. I actually wrote this in a different context, in a kind of interview. I'd been asked questions about my early school and so on. And when I read it, I thought this will work as a piece on its own, you know.
Mm.
So I'm just trying to find it here.
Page 37, and it certainly worked for me, put me right there on that path with you, but also something of how you look beyond that road.
Well, indeed, I mean... Well, I think I just can read it then.
Sure.
The Lagan's Road. The Lagan's Road ran for about 3/4 of a mile across an area of wetlands. It was one of those narrow country roads with weeds in the middle, grass verges and high hedges on either side, and all around it marsh and rushes and little shrubs and birch trees. For a minute or two every day, therefore, you were in the wilderness. But on the first morning I went to school, it was as if the Queen of Elfland were leading me away. The McNichols were neighbours, and Philomena McNichol had been put in charge of me during those first days. Ginger hair, freckled face, green gym frock. A fae, if ever there was one. I remember my first sight of the school. A couple of low-set Nissen huts raising their corrugated backs above the hedges. From about 1/4 mile away, I could see youngsters running about in the road in front of the buildings and hear shouting in the playground. Years later, when I read an account of how the Indians of the Pacific Northwest foresaw their arrival in the land of the dead, coming along a forest path where other travellers' cast-offs lay scattered on the bushes, hearing voices laughing and calling, knowing there was a life in the clearing up ahead that would be familiar, but feeling at the same time lost and homesick, it struck me I had already experienced that kind of arrival. Next thing, in the porch, I was faced with rows of coat hooks nailed up at different heights along the wall, so that everyone in the different classes could reach them. Everyone had a place to hang overcoat or scarf and proceed into the strange room where our names were new in the roll book and would soon be called.
Seamus Heaney, reading from District and Circle, some found prose there, entitled it The Lagan's Road, an Irish boy looking along the road to school, and now, at 67, also remembering Indians of the Pacific Northwest foreseeing their arrival in the land of the dead. Seamus Heaney, lots of listeners want to talk with you. I'd like to begin to turn to them. Bobby's calling from Boston. Hi, Bobby, you're on the air.
Hello, Seamus.
Hi, Bobby.
How are you? Did you get
Bobby
my T-shirt
Breen?
I sent you?
I think this is Bobby Breen of the very helmet poem in this collection.
Good, Bobby. Marvelous. Absolutely.
How are you, my friend?
Very good.
I should set this up for our readers. You've got a poem entitled Helmet. It starts off Bobby Breen's, his Boston fireman's gift with Breen and scarlet letters on its spread, fantailing brim, helmet about the fireman. And that's you, Bobby.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, Bobby made me a present of this mighty helmet over 20 years ago, and it sat on my shelf. It was, I was saying to people, it was like a Homeric gift or a gift given out in Beowulf, a mighty helmet.
You call it the headgear of the tribe, leather-trimmed, yes. Steel-ridged, hand-tooled, hand-sewn, tipped with a little bud of beaten copper, the helmet.
Yeah, well, Bobby came to a reading when our mutual friend Desmond O'Grady, another poet, was reading with me in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he made this. It was like an exchange between King Hrothgar and Beowulf, or you know, in he handed this mighty object to me, and I've always had a sense that it required a poetic salute, but I was dumb as I sat watching it, and then, you know, I translated Beowulf, and I thought maybe you should do it here now, and then.
Yeah.
Of course, after 9/11,
yeah.
the thing attained a new aura and majesty. So,
Bobby, did he capture it, the poetry of your helmet?
Oh, yeah, of course. I tried a few times, but I kept sending the poem off to him till I finally gave up and said, you do it, master. You write it. Yeah. And he did.
Yeah. That's great. Okay.
Did you get the T-shirt I sent you?
Not yet, Bobby. When did you send it?
I sent it off the other day.
I know, I've been away.
Beautiful for your birthday, yeah, and my birthday in June. I sent you off a beautiful firefighter's T-shirt. I was hoping you got
it. I'm sorry, it hasn't. I mean, I've been off the pitch for the last 3 weeks. So,
okay, still on the road.
So I'll let you know when I get back.
They're just in from Ireland. First, Bobby, you sent them the headgear of the tribe, and now a T-shirt. Maybe we'll be reading a poem entitled T-shirt in a few years. Bobby Breen, thank you so much for calling. Let me get another call from Shelburne, Vermont. Danny's on the line. Hi, Danny, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Heaney. A lot of your poems resonate me as far as like handwork and all that. I'm a blacksmith myself, and I would love to hear from you how your experiences on the farm and sort of with the wilderness that you were talking about in that last poem about the road that you read, how have you used those things in the rest of life, in the city, to deal with the things that you come across?
Well, I don't know that I've used them. I mean, they've just been part of my inner memory equipment. And it has to be said that...
those experiences, I mean.
I call upon them. Sir, it's more in terms of the mystery of writing. In the writing of lyric poetry, what are you after? You're after a kind of the authenticity, a solitude, and connection at the same time.
Yeah.
And I connect with myself. I feel authentic, and I feel oddly alone again in a kind of childish space when I think of a lot of those things. It's not the only kind of poem I write, I should say, but when I feel that there is a kind of banister or pathway that can be completely relied upon when I'm in literally in touch through language with those things.
Seamus Heaney, we're going to hear some other flavor of poem when we hear you read District and Circle, but if we've got a blacksmith on the line, I don't know how not to have you read your poem from this collection, Poet to Blacksmith. Could you read that for Danny, for all of us?
Yeah, this is a translation of a poem by Owen Roa O'Sullivan. It's as 18th century poet who wrote in the Irish language, but he was also a labourer and a spadesman, spalpeen as they called him in Irish. Mm. So the actual spade was a very important item in his, you know, his equipment. He gives instructions to Seamus MacGarrel, the blacksmith Seamus MacGarrel, to make him a spade. And I translated it from the Irish and I kept the original meter. It's a terrific swing to it. So, Poet to Blacksmith, Owen Roa O'Sullivan, instructions to Seamus MacGarrel to make him a spade. Seamus, make me a sidearm to take on the earth, a suitable tool for digging and grubbing the ground, lightsome and pleasant to lean on or cut with or lift, tastily finished and trim and fit for the hand. No trace of the hammer to show in the sheen of the blade, the thing to have purchase and spring and be fit for the strain, the shaft to be socketed in dead true and dead straight, and I'll work with the gang till I drop and never complain. The plate and the edge of it not to be wrinkly or crooked, I see it well shaped from the anvil and sharp from the file, the grain of the wood and the line of the shaft nicely fitted, and best thing of all, the ring of it sweet as a bell.
Another great passage from your Nobel lecture Seamus, you're talking about that childhood when you were huddled together with your brothers and sisters, as susceptible and impressionable as the drinking water that stood in a bucket in our scullery every time a passing train made the earth shake. The surface of that water used to ripple delicately, concentrically, and in utter silence. The title poem in this collection is about a train, but it's underground. It's a longer poem. I wish you'd set it up and read it for us.
Well, this is... It began with a memory of going down into the London Underground and meeting a guy playing a tin whistle, busking on the steps, always an Irish chap. And the question, which I'm afraid I still haven't resolved, every time I meet him, I said, well, on one hand, he wants you to throw him a few shillings. On the other hand, I felt maybe looking him in the eye and stopping for a second, listening to the music and nodding and paying attention to him confers more value on him. It's a kind of a little dilemma. And then the character goes deeper into the underground, and he's on an underground journey because in some way the encounter with the guy at the entrance is like entering the classical underworld where you pay for your journey into the land of the dead.
And Dante, of course, one of your great heroes, breathing in this poem.
That's right. Well, this is five sonnets. I mean, it's quite a lengthy business, but I'll read them and see what happens. District and Circle. Tunes from a tin whistle underground. Curled up a corridor, I'd be walking down to where I knew I was always going to find my watcher on the tiles. Cap by his side, his fingers perked, his two eyes eyeing me in an unaccusing look I'd not avoid, or not just yet, since both were out to sea for ourselves. As the music larked and capered, I'd trigger and untrigger a hot coin held at the ready, but now my gaze was lowered, for was our traffic not in recognition? A corded passage, I would repocket and nod, and he, still eyeing me, would also nod. Posted, eyes front, along the dreamy ramparts of escalators, ascending and descending to a monotonous slight rocking in the works, we were moved along, upstanding. Elsewhere, underneath, an engine powered, rumbled, quickened, evened, quieted. The white tiles gleamed. In passages that flowed with draughts from cooler tunnels, I missed the light of all-overing, long-since mysterious day. Parks at lunchtime, where the sunners lay on body-heated mown grass regardless. A resurrection scene, minutes before the resurrection. Habitués of their garden of delights, of staggered summer. Another level down, the platform thronged. I re-entered the safety of numbers, a crowd half straggle-raveled and half strung like a human chain, the pushy newcomers jostling and purling underneath the vault, on their marks to be first through the doors, street loud, then succumbing to herd quiet. Had I betrayed or not, myself or him? Always new to me, always familiar, this unrepentant, now repentant turn, as I stood waiting, glad of a first tremor, then caught up in the now-or-never whelm of one and all, the full length of the train. Stepping onto it across the gap, onto the carriage metal, I reached to grab the stubby black roofwort and take my stand from planted ball of heel to heel of hand, as sweet traction and heavy downslump stayed me. I was on my way, well girded, yet on edge, spot-rooted, buoyed, aloof, listening to the dwindling noises off, my back to the unclosed door, the platform empty, and wished it could have lasted, that long between-times pause, before the budge and glaze over, when any forwardness was unwelcome, and bodies readjusted, blindsided to themselves and other bodies. So, deeper into it, crowd-swept, strap-hanging, my lofted arm a swivel like a flail, my father's glazed face in my own waning and craning. Again the growl of shutting doors, the jolt and one-off treble of iron on iron, then a long centrifugal haulage of speed through every dragging socket. And so, by night and day, to be transported through galleried earth with them, the only relict of all that I belong to, hurtled forward, reflecting in a window, mirror backed by blasted, weeping rock walls, flicker lit.
Seamus Heaney reading their District and Circle from his collection by the same name. You spoke earlier about the age of anxiety that you see us living in now. You write there of, I was on my way, well girded yet on edge, and we can't read this without thinking of the London Underground bombings. I wonder if this poem preceded those or came after?
Excuse me. Well, as a matter of fact, the first poem and the last poem of that sequence were written in May 2005.
Wow.
It was a couple of 3 months. It was July that the bomb occurred, or so, the bombings occurred.
So your blasted, weeping rock walls written before the bombing.
Yes, they were. But they are, of course, if you go through those London tubes, it is like taking a Dantesque journey. There's always something of a dream element, I think. When you stand, you reach up, you hang yourself onto one of those roof warts, as I call them, or you grab a rail, the train starts, there's a kind of hypnosis or mesmerism in the motion of the rails. You go under the earth, you enter a changed state. I mean, of course, it sounds melodramatic when you say it, I guess, but something like that occurs. People switch off, as they say, especially in London Underground. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in describing that abstracted state, which, of course, after the bombs, I just added a couple of three more poems, which are not referring to bombings, but they are just trying to establish that dream state. And so the character could be on a mythic underground journey to the land of the dead, or he could just be taking an underground journey to the next few stations along and going through that entranced condition. The poem was slightly mysterious to me myself while being completely ordinary. I was recalling an experience I had very, very often. The first time I was in London was for 6 weeks in the early 60s when I had a holiday job, and I went from Earls Court Station to St James's Station. And there's a reference to parks at lunchtime where, not the sinners, but the sunners.
The sunners, right.
And I always remember as a kind of just a newly fledged, I just had got my BA degree, I was kind of about 20, and this sensual life was lying around in the London parks, so near and yet so far. So it's a recollection of that time, and I called it Staggered Summer because, I mean, the summer was staggered by showers of rain, but I thought that I could allow myself at least that much allusion or suggestion of a summer broken by danger.
Let me ask you, speaking, though, of that summer broken by danger, I mean, this question may sound absurd to you, but in a way, what do we treasure poets for? They open themselves up, their antennae are so long and sensitive. Does it make a poem, a poet, a kind of medium? In some way, writing this in May of 05, are you somehow anticipating what happened in July of 05 when those weeping rock walls were blasted?
I'm very, very cautious about saying that the poet has powers to, you know, predict that. Absolutely uneasy. What the thing is that the mythic outback of the poem, if you like, you know, the question... Aeneas goes down into the underworld to see his father, and there's a glimpse of a father at the end of that poem. I think what gives the poem not predictive future force, but ongoing staying power is the link to a mythic thing. A myth, in a way, is a passport to eternity. You know, if you link into it, you're in an eternal present, and it was that sense of going on a testing, menaced journey. that is, I think, forever with people. It just so happens that in a terrible way for the people in those trains that morning, the anticipated dream dread came right out into real life, you know.
Seamus Heaney, Anthony Kuda reviewed your new collection in the Washington Post. He happens to be calling in right now from Atlanta, Georgia. I want to turn to him. Tony Kuda, welcome. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air with Seamus Heaney.
Thank you very much. Hello, Mr. Heaney.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Well, I was thrilled to read the new volume and just really loved it and was excited to get to do something on it. Listen, I've got a question. I hope it's not a scholar's question. I don't think it is. There's a line in your early poem called Personal Helicon that I, and a lot of people I'm sure really love. You say near the end that I rhyme now to see myself, to set the darkness echoing. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, since you've come through the kind of spirit level, out of the darkness and through the spirit level and electric light, and now you seem to be going back into a kind of dark area. I'm wondering, in general, if you think that poetry really helps us that darkness ever really lightens, that poetry really helps us to know ourselves, or if it really is about hearing ourselves think in a way.
Well, I have to say that I did. I inhabited an age of Irish anxiety all during the Troubles. And in the 70s and 80s, I felt called upon, in a way, to answer that. And I did so in different ways, writing elegies and making responses to what was going on. Then I thought, well, poetry has its inner freedom too. It's a kind of spirit leveler, or raising the spirit level is part of its job, instead of just writing in response to things. So I freed myself out of the moment, if you like. But I have to say that after 9/11 and after the consequences of 9/11, I felt that, once again, to use the language of the catechism, our understanding was darkened, you know. And I did feel implicated, called upon. And I was lucky to find some way. I mean, there aren't many poems there directly about the situation, but they are personal. Of course they're personal. But as I was saying earlier, I tried to imbue them with an awareness of our more dangerous times.
Tony Kuda in Atlanta, thanks very much for calling in.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Heaney.
Thank you, Tony.
Tony Kuda, he reviewed District and Circle for the Washington Post, teaches at Emory College. There's so many things we could ask, but the poems speak best for themselves. I wonder if you could read your last, The Blackbird of Glanmore, Seamus Heaney.
I'm very fond of this poem. I'm glad you asked me to read it. Irish literature abounds in poems about blackbirds. They're in the hedge of the tradition, hopping about all the time. And some of the earliest poems that survived, 9th century poems from the Northern Irish area, the Blackbird of Belfast Loch, for example, is a 9th century poem, always praising the gold beaks and so on.
Please take it to us. We've got just 3 minutes here.
Okay. So this is the Blackbird of Glanmore.
Yes.
On the grass when I arrive, filling the stillness with life, but ready to scare off at the very first wrong move. In the ivy when I leave, it's you, blackbird, I love. I park, pause, take heed, breathe, just breathe and sit, and lines I once translated come back. I want a way to the house of death, to my father under the low clay roof. And I think of one gone to him, a little stillness dancer, hunter, son, lost brother, cavorting through the yard, so glad to see me home, my homesick first term over. And think of a neighbour's words long after the accident. Yon bird on the shed roof, up on the ridge for weeks. I said nothing at the time, but I never liked yon bird. The automatic lock clunk shut. The blackbird's panic is short-lived. For a second, I've a bird's-eye view of myself, a shadow on raked gravel in front of my house of life. Hedge hop, I am absolute for you, your ready talk back, your each standoffish comeback, your picky, nervy gold beak. On the grass when I arrive, in the ivy when I leave.
Seamus Heaney with the Blackbird of Glanmore and the lost brother there, your own brother.
That is so, yes. Early 53, we had an accident in the family. The second youngest of the family was knocked down on a road accident just outside our house. And I wrote actually a poem in my first book called Midterm Break. But as I say, the old lady who lived beside us months after the accident said that she had seen a bird on the roof and she saw it as an omen of something dangerous that was going to happen. She said, I never liked yon bird.
You point to omens for us, some dark and some light, and we're grateful for all of them. Grateful for your time today. Glad we caught you just off the plane from Ireland. Congratulations on the new collection. It's absolutely wonderful. Seamus Heaney, Nobel laureate, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Tom. It's been marvelous. Thank you very much.
Seamus Heaney, Irish poet, Nobel laureate from 1995. The music we've heard this hour is from the Irish piper, Liam O'Flynn, who collaborated with Seamus Heaney on an album called The Poet and the Piper. Listeners, you can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette and Angel Cozzelli. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.